Hello, and welcome to the Joffrey and Family Fellows podcast, a public humanities project for Miami University's Humanities Center. My name is Emily Brady, and I am one of six undergraduate Joffrey and Family Fellows for the 2019-2020 school year. As part of the Altman Lecture Series on Time and Temporality, we are interviewing various experts in an attempt to illuminate interdisciplinary perspectives on the nature of time, how we think about it, and our place in it. As part of the lecture series, Dr. Jack Halberstam, a tenured professor in the Department of English and Comparative Literature and the Institute for Research on Women, Gender, and Sexuality at Columbia University, was brought in to discuss his work and gave a lecture entitled, After All, on Dereliction and Destitution. Recently, Dr. Halberstam was kind enough to sit down with us and discuss and clarify his ideas at length. We started the interview with a somewhat general question related to time. We wanted to know when time was most apparent to Dr. Halberstam, along with when he felt most connected to the past, present, and future.
You know, unfortunately, the way in which we experience time and the way in which we express that experience is attached to a lot of different cliches because, you know, if you're bored, time moves slowly. If you're engrossed in something, time stand still. So I think it's more interesting to think about moments when one feels out of time, you know, and over the course of a lifetime, there are lots of opportunities to feel out of time as you get older. It's quite interesting, especially as a teacher, because you're often in relationship to young people. And, you know, when you begin teaching, the difference in age between you and the students is pretty small. So as you continue, it's an interesting thing to be, feel as if there's a generational gulf that opens up slowly. And it's, you know, especially given the what some people would call the acceleration of time in our technological moment. As somebody raised without social media and without even like TV really, it's dizzying sometimes to be in relationship to students who are in relationship to multiple devices and therefore inhabit multiple temporalities. So I prefer to think in terms of, you know, feeling out of time or somehow, you know, at odds with time. So some of the work that I've been thinking about and that I presented on in relationship to the 1970s, which was more sort of my teenage years and a time when I explored things like punk and subcultures and so on, you know, looking back at that period now, I honestly can't even imagine that world anymore. It's really like something that is in another galaxy. So time is super interesting in the way in which it makes the familiar foreign to us.
In his talk, Dr. Halberstam mentioned an archive of dreams, and we asked him how it could be used to push back against normative propulsive temporality, which we know as the present.
Well, when I was talking about an archive of dreams, I'm really sort of lifting that idea from Robin Kelly's Freedom Dreams. And he makes the really compelling argument in that book that just because a political movement did not, in conventional terms, succeed, does not mean that everything that became the content, political, aesthetic content of that movement is not wasted. In fact, it becomes part of what he calls freedom dreams. It becomes an archive of all the ways in which people in the past imagined their way through the various impasses that they themselves faced. It seems really important, particularly as humanities people, to go back and think about what was the political fantasy of an earlier moment. And just to give an example of that, again, a more dystopian one, if you go look at the queer groups of the 60s and 70s and the way they imagined LGBT liberation, it was not in terms of marriage. So the way in which gay marriage became the political goal of this past generation of activists is a complete betrayal, in fact, of an earlier moment in which radical queer people imagined that there would be an opportunity to demonstrate solidarity with other oppressed groups, join forces, and take aim at an anti-racist, at a racist society through anti-racism and anti-poverty issues and measures. And instead, in a way, what happened was through this reorientation towards business and the accumulation of wealth for more people, we were persuaded, people were persuaded that getting married would give you access, a shortcut, if you like, to the status that you desired. And for middle-class people, that probably was true, but it didn't do anything for anyone who was struggling with issues around money, class, racial inequities, any of those things. Those were not addressed by marriage. So freedom dreams are important because they remind us to look and see whether we hit a certain kind of, you know, activist benchmark that earlier generations imagined. And in most cases, we have not. We've actually settled, compromised, and, you know, consented to dreams that fall well short of the transformative politics that you know, motivated earlier generations.
Right. So you would say that, like, gay marriage as a policy, for example, would be sort of buying into this normative temporality instead of subverting the system and actually...
Look, when I wrote that book, In a Queer Time and Place, that was published in 2005, what I was calling queer temporality then was a temporality that was out of sync with the family, in which a child, let's say a teenager, didn't have to measure out their life according to, well, I'll go to college, then I'll meet a guy /girl, we'll get married, we'll have babies, we'll raise those babies, we'll retire, we'll die. I mean, that's basically the heterosexual marriage plot. And it's fine if that's your arc of possibility and your imaginary, but one of the amazing things about being queer at a certain moment was realizing, oh my God, I can drop that whole narrative. I don't have to get married. I don't have to sort of pass out my life in relationship to these utterly normative markers of time and development. And I can imagine my life differently. That was clear in that book. And here we are, you know, some 10, 15 years later, and that's not at all been the vision of temporality in queer communities. Queer communities have said, we want acceptance. We want to get married. We want the picket fence. We want that romance and that recognition and that acceptance that all of our straight friends have. But the thing is that you kind of don't realize as a young person is that, well, marriage just isn't all it's cracked up to be. We live in a country where some 60% of all marriages end in divorce. When that's the case, then the normative outcome for marriage is divorce. More than 50%. Well, more than 50%. So heterosexuality, because it isn't a self-critical field, because it's taken for granted that this is just the way we are, doesn't have that kind of, these kinds of internal critiques around the temporality of heterosexual life. And it means that I think life unfolds in ways that people just don't expect, but they don't have the means to critique it. They're just in it. It's hard to get out of it.
Halberstam then went into discussing the relationship between anarchitecture and trans identities. According to the Spatial Agency, anarchitecture was named as a combination of anarchy and architecture, and was a critique of the modernist impulses of contemporary culture within which architecture was conceived as a symbol for that culture's worst excesses and drawbacks.
Gordon Matta-Clark himself was responding to Le Corbusier, who his father had worked with Le Corbusier and then broken from his ideas. So this is a very significant part of Gordon Matta-Clark's thinking about architecture is in relationship to this towering figure of modern architecture. He's recognizing that if building things and building cities and planning cities in a certain way is is a particular kind of exercise of power, then unbuilding would would be another kind of exercise of resistance, let's say. So it's a, what I'm trying to lay out is a very conceptual thing. It's like saying, if we agree that architecture is a way of shaping an environment that can then have an impact on the way people think, the way people move through space, the way people conceive of the political, then unbuilding must have some of the same logics attached to it. So that's the point about an architecture. Its relationship to trans and queer life is to say that the reconceptualization of the body that goes on for a queer person or a trans person, you can find a metaphor for that in the cuts that Matt Clark made to some of the structures that he worked with. If sex reassignment is, for example, a surgery, is a series of cuts made on a body that is understood one way, and after the cuts is understood a different way, then you can see that, in fact, transgender is not the making of a new body, it's the unbuilding of an old body. So you can see what I'm trying to do is use a different conceptual language to talk about something that then pulls back from the propulsive language of becoming, making, doing, because that language is the language of capitalism and is the language of neoliberal incorporation, and instead is offering us a different orientation to the built environment, the body, and then the place of queer and trans bodies within that.
This has been the Geoffrian Fellows interview with Dr. Jack Halberstam, Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. We would like to thank the Humanities Center for making all of this possible, and we would like to thank Dr. Halberstam once again for taking the time to speak with us. Please join us again for our upcoming discussion with Dr. Marsha Bjornerud on how thinking like a geologist can save the world.